Trigger warning. This episode of UndocuLife may contain content that may be triggering for some listeners. We discuss sensitive topics regarding suicide and self-harm. If you are someone who is dealing with mental health challenges, please seek help and know that you are not alone. There are resources provided at the end of the episode transcript, which you can find on Hola Cultura's UndocuLife website. Thank you. Hi, my name is Jose Luis Mendoza, and I am the co-host of Hola Cultura's new bilingual podcast, UndocuLife, with support from the DC Oral History Collaborative. Second grade was the first time my undocumented status broke my heart. I was an exemplary student. My teacher would place stars next to the names of those that exceeded expectations. The space next to my name was littered with stars, so when the night of parent-teacher conferences arrived, I was beyond excited to make my parents proud. My teacher's report surely was glowing. She even suggested that I could skip a grade if I kept up my achievements. Then she found out I was undocumented. I don't remember the exact words, but I do remember the shift in tone. It felt like the whole room pitied me. By my fifth grade graduation, I still got really good grades, but college was the dream that definitely felt a lot more fictional than plausible in my life. Through middle school, my heart would sink anytime I'd hear the word deportation. In the same way that some kids tell ghost stories, kids at my school would talk about ICE, La Migra, where they were recently spotted, who they had recently pulled over and deported. Anytime my father worked a graveyard shift, or my mom took too long to get back from the grocery store, my heart would pound. I feared that they'd been pulled over and detained for deportation. Thanks to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, I now have a college degree and I'm 18 months into a career. I've been promoted twice, and yet my heart skips a beat anytime the words breaking news and DACA pop up on my phone screen. In spite of my success, everything I've worked for feels unsustainable, and the circumstances that control that feeling are out of my control. Experts say such feelings can take a toll on mental health. In fact, mental health challenges are so common today among all kinds of people that more than 50 million were coping with mental illness in the United States in 2020. That's nearly one in every five people in the country, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. Mental health problems can alter a person's life and daily routine, even if the challenges the person faces are not immediately visible on the surface. For immigrants, the trauma of leaving the home country and seeking asylum is stressful. Even more so for those living with the uncertainty of not having legal standing. DACA recipients may face the stress of their legal status constantly being challenged in court. All of these situations can take a toll on your mental health. Asylum seekers and refugees in particular are more likely to experience mental health challenges. A report from the American Psychiatric Association found that one out of every three asylum seekers had high rates of anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Another study published by the Journal of Social Service Research in 2019 found that Latina migrants experience higher rates of PTSD than the citizen population at large. Unfortunately, when immigrants seek treatment, they often risk stigmatization from their families and communities. Experts state this fear prevents many immigrants from seeking help. Even when immigrants take the courageous step of seeking help, they are often unable to access mental health services. The National Alliance on Mental Health found that only 35% of Latino adults with mental illnesses receive treatment, compared to the U.S. average of 46%. Barriers faced by undocumented immigrants include language, cost, the fear of deportation, and lack of insurance. But stigma was the number one cultural factor reported as preventing immigrants in general from seeking mental health care, even if they are covered, according to a 2015 study published in the Journal of American Psychiatric Association. In this episode, we spoke with Maria Nunez Pereira, who was born in El Salvador and arrived in the U.S. in 2005 when she was 5 years old. Maria is now a criminal justice student at the University of the District of Columbia and talked candidly about her own mental health struggles and the family and societal pressure she feels to be a model immigrant. Here's our interview with Maria, conducted by a former fellow at Hola Cultura, Delia Beristain Noriega, back in August of 2021.
We just want to start from the beginning. So if you can tell us your full name, date of birth, and a little bit about what your hometown is like.
So my name is Maria Nunez Pereira. My birthday is July 10th, 2001. And I was born in San Miguel. It's El Cantón Chaparrastique. It's like a calle. So there's like houses. It's not too big. It's like a little small little area.
And what are some of your earliest memories from growing up there?
There was a solar. So it's like a little just piece of land and right in front of where I grew up. And I remember going with my grandpa and finding little, it's called cusucos. They're like little animals that live under the soil. So we would go all the time and just look for them. That's the biggest memory that I had.
So you, like, who are the people that you grew up around?
I grew up around my grandma, my grandpa. We lived in the same house. I had my two cousins who are both girls, my aunt, my uncles. So yeah, it was a large family.
Yeah, big family. Yeah. And can you tell me a little bit about them, maybe their names and how you got along with everyone?
So my two cousins, when I lived there, because now there's more, I have more cousins, but during that time, both of my cousins, one was Susana Pereira and the older one was Irene. My two uncles, Jimmy Pereira and Pablo, and then my aunt, Lisania, and my other aunt was Glenda, and my grandma, we call her Concha, and my lovely grandfather, his name is Francisco.
And what are some of the things that you remember doing with them?
I would remember every time it would rain, I would go over my cousin's house, over Susana Irene's house, and little big like turtles would just come out of, because it would be raining. So that was like a memory that I have, just when it rained, like I would always go there because that's what I wanted to see, was like turtles walking freely. I remember my cousin Susana, she's 1 year younger than me, and we would always fight, like cousin fight, but since we were small, for some reason the way we fought was biting each other. So we would always have arguments and end up like biting each other. And it was just this big like situation. But yeah, and I remember just like being around them, like on a daily basis, I would just be surrounded by my family members. Like there wouldn't be a day where I felt alone or I would be alone. Like I would just either be with my grandma, my grandpa, or my cousins, my aunt, and my uncles. So.
And what about your parents, if you don't mind me asking?
My parents, they lived with my grandma and my grandpa. Actually, we lived, so it's like this big land. Our house was literally right next to my grandma's house. It's the same land, so it's like we just lived together technically. They were there when I grew up. They had a tourist visa, so they would come from El Salvador to here, to the United States, frequently. So during those times, I would stay with my grandma and my grandpa. They were there, but they were mostly, like, flying.
And what were they doing? Like, were they working? Or what were their reasons for traveling?
One, to visit my aunt, my mom's sister, and secondly, from what I've heard, they were viajeros. So they would bring like packages that people from El Salvador wanted to send to the United States, or from like the United States to El Salvador. So they would, you know, do that.
What is your earliest memory, I guess, of making that connection between El Salvador and the United States that you remember? Or the first time you heard about it, I guess, when you became aware that your parents were doing that and traveling a lot.
I don't really have a memory, to be honest. I just found out when I was here, like growing up, I didn't even know. I always thought that like my mom and my dad, like, cause they worked in an office in El Salvador. So that's what I knew. I didn't really know that they were viajeros until later on in my life.
It's interesting. And then I guess, what do you remember about going to school in El Salvador, and what grades did you go to over there?
So supposedly I have a memory of me going to, I think it's pre-K or Head Start. I don't really remember. But I do have that memory of me going to school. And so recently I have found out that I wasn't really enrolled into school. Like, I didn't have the age. They would just take me there because I wanted to go. So like, it's kind of confusing, but like, I went to, I think it was pre-K. But I didn't really have the age to go there. But they would still take me because I wanted to go. And like, the teachers were like, yeah, just bring her. And then she could just play with the kids. And yeah, so that's what I know.
And how old were you when you came here? Do you remember?
I was 5. Yeah, I had recently turned 5.
And I mean, what do you remember about that, if anything, about how came here, who you came with?
I came with my mom and my dad. I came in with a tourist visa. Well, I didn't really remember, but there's always been like that. I feel like I have like a memory where I just remember it was like really dark and I was in the airplane and like all I just saw was like clouds and I was really scared of the dark. I would be with my mom, like cuddled with her because I was scared, but that's what I remember. But my mom was telling me that I didn't really know, because I actually did not know that I was moving to the United States. I thought that we were just coming to visit. I didn't really know we were gonna stay. So my mom had told me that day where I was leaving, it was really like dark outside. And my grandma was like saying bye to us. And then she said, as when we were leaving, like I turned around and I was like, don't be sad, grandma. Like, I'm just gonna come. I'm like, I'm gonna be back. Like, don't worry. And then my mom was like, she started crying because she's like, the fact that you didn't really know that we were gonna come, like we weren't going to come back.
And when did you start having those conversations with your parents about why or how you came?
I started having these conversations when I turned, I think, 15. Because, you know, growing up, I didn't really talk about it. I think it was just, I'm here. I don't know how to say it. Like, I felt like I didn't really want to talk about it, to be honest. I felt like during those times, like, I didn't even want to be here. I missed my family in El Salvador. So I never really had those conversations with my parents until when I turned 15, which was when DACA came into the conversation, and we started having conversations about our immigration to here.
Okay. And I guess, what are some of your earliest memories here once you start living here, and where did you arrive to?
So when we came to the United States, we went straight to Texas because that's where my uncle and my aunt and my cousins live. We stayed there for a couple months and then we moved to Maryland, stayed there for like most of my childhood. So I don't really have that much memory of when I went to Texas when I first came. I just remember a little bit of going to different places. We went to this like boat thing in this like river. That's mostly all I remember. But when I came to Maryland, I don't really have that much memories. I just have the memory of our first Christmas here. It was pretty cold. Was not used to that. And I remember having my first present. My cousin gave it to me. It was like a little snowball and it had like a Santa hat, and then it had like the two little eyes, and then like the carrot nose, and then like the smiley thing, the smiley face, and then like his little arms and his little legs. I still have it to this day.
And when you say your first present, was it just the first present from celebrating Christmas here, or first present in general of all Christmases?
First present here. Like, that was the first present I had ever gotten in the United States.
Do you remember any family Christmases or any other traditions back home that you celebrated?
So, when we celebrate Christmas over there, we do, like, fireworks and stuff. So, I remember everybody gathering up and just, like, doing the fireworks. And they're called, like, the sparkling sticks. I don't really know how to, like, what's the right name, but I do remember, like, we would do that every Christmas and every New Year's.
And what year did you start going to school here?
I think I was 6. So I didn't go until, like, after 1 year of being here in the United States. I remember it was pretty tough because I didn't know, like, English. I was actually put into ESOL. And what also made it worse was I actually had surgery before I went into school, and they still had to do accommodations since, like, my surgery was, for example, like, I couldn't sit down in the floor because, you know, they did like crisscross applesauce. I couldn't do that. I had to sit in a chair since of my surgery. So I feel like that also made it a little bit tough on me because, of course, I didn't know English. And on top of that, like, I had these, like, accommodations that I feel like made me stand out, which I didn't want to.
And what school did you go to?
It's called Thomas Stone Elementary School. I lived with my aunt during that time, and that was the school that was in our area. So that's the school that I had to go to.
And what was it like living with your aunt?
It was pretty good. I mean, sometimes you want to have, like, your own space, but we had our own little room, which would be, like, me, my mom, and my dad would sleep. So it wasn't like we had our own space. It was just the room to us. It was pretty cool. I had my cousin from my other aunt, my other uncle, they lived upstairs. So I would go up and, like, play with him. It was really nice to have family around me, especially during those times. But it was tough at the same time because, of course, like, I didn't really know them. Like, I knew them from pictures and, like, I would talk to them on the phone, but it wasn't really, like, I didn't really know them like that.
And what part of Maryland was this?
This was Brentwood, Maryland, so, like, in Hyattsville.
And I guess going back to school and what that was like, what do you remember of growing up here, right? Like, what other schools did you go to, and what were those experiences like?
I've only been to Thomas Stone Elementary School. Then I had to move to D.C. since we had to get insurance, because during that time I did start having mental health problems, and it was something that my parents couldn't really afford without insurance. So we had to move to D.C. and then I went to a D.C. school, which it was different. I think Maryland schools, the environment is different from D.C. schools. I actually went, it's called Bases D.C. It's like this, it's like a school without walls type of school. So it was pretty difficult for me because I wasn't prepared to go into a school like that. I had like pre-algebra at like 6th grade. So it was something that I wasn't really like mentally prepared. I had like AP classes. It was something I was not prepared for, from going to like a Maryland school to that type of school in DC. So that did mess me up. And then after that, I didn't want to stay there anymore. So I went to Chavez, which I stayed there from like 8th to 9th. And then after that, I went to Paul, which is the school I graduated from.
That's high school, right?
Yeah, that's high school.
Okay. And now that you mentioned, you know, I guess not feeling prepared for that kind of environment initially, what kind of resources, if any, were available to you that you know of? Or if none, like, how did that affect you?
There was sometimes some resources, like, we call it, like, student hours, where you would come after school and then they would try to help you. But I think that my knowledge, I just felt like, again, I was not, educational-wise, I was not prepared for that. There were some things where I didn't understand. And no matter how I would tell them, like, hey, I really don't understand, and this is something that I haven't been taught, they couldn't really, like, help me, which also took a really big toll on my mental health.
And do you mind sharing in what ways? Or if it's too personal, you don't have to.
No, of course. So I just felt like, since I didn't really understand it, that I wasn't smart enough, that I wasn't good enough in a way. Especially, I feel like what sometimes we don't really talk about is the pressure that immigrant children have to go through. Like, I would feel pressured of trying to be good in school. And if I wasn't good in school, then, like, my parents would be upset. And it's understandable for them to be upset, because, of course, we've gone through so much for them to bring me here, to, like, me not doing good in school. And it was something that they wanted me to, you know, be good in school. So the fact that I wasn't doing good, I feel like just it was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it's understandable. And what did that pressure look like at home, I guess?
It was mostly like, so the teachers would, like, communicate with my parents and, like, no, Maria's not doing good in these exams. Maria's not doing good in homework. And so having them, like, tell that to my parents would kind of get upset and then would tell me, you have to go to, like, these student hours, like, you have to. And sometimes it was like, if I didn't go, they would get upset with me. And I didn't want them to get upset with me. But at the same time, I felt like even if I went to those student hours, I couldn't really understand what they were trying to teach me. So, well, I was like, then what's the point?
And was this connected to the language barrier, you think? Or were there other obstacles in the way, too?
I feel like that is a part of it. Like, till this day, sometimes I do struggle. Let's say, for example, like, reading. There's still some things that I feel like, because of the language, that, you know, English is my second language, there I still struggle with it. But definitely during that time, I was struggling a lot.
Did you express that concern to your parents at one point? Because you said you transferred schools, right? So what was the conversation like, and, you know, how did they react?
So I wasn't doing good in school. I had to, you know, stay back. I stayed back once, and as much as I tried, it just wasn't working for me, and I was going to stay back again. So I told my parents, look, I don't feel prepared. I don't feel like I'm doing the best I can in this school, and I'm honestly not in the right mindset right now. So I feel like I need to transfer school. Like, I need a change. And so they agreed with it.
And how old were you, or what grade was this?
This was 8th grade.
And I guess over the course of those years, in elementary and middle school, can you talk a little bit about what your social life was like, right? Because you were adjusting to a new environment, so what new things were you exposed to, or were you making any friends? What was that like?
I was making friends. For my elementary school, it was kind of tough. My social life wasn't really that good. I was bullied but I didn't really talk about it. It was like little comments or actions that people made, but I didn't really talk about it. I didn't make it seen. But I would have a couple friends, but in middle school, I did have several friends, especially after I got out of that environment of elementary school. I was able to make friends, like, till this day, I have a friend, my best friend, that I met in eighth grade.
And going back a little bit, I'm just kind of curious about what things surprised you when you came here. Like, what are some of the new things you were introduced to? Maybe that now it's kind of like, you know, taken for granted, but like that in the beginning it surprised you, or comparisons that you made between here and home?
I feel like the biggest thing was, like, in El Salvador, you literally could just run around. I feel like you have so much more freedom over there. Like, you could play soccer literally in the middle of the street and nobody says anything. In here, it's more people in just a small area. So I feel like it's mostly, like, the freedom. Especially little kids, it's more freedom over there. Here, technology is, like, a big thing. And over there, it's really not.
And I guess going back to school, what was it like once you transfer? You know, how did things change for you, whether not just at school, but at home, maybe?
When I changed from Basis to Chavez, it was also a pretty big change. The environment was way different. Basis was kind of like white population. Like, the kids were mostly like white. And I went to Chavez, which is like literally at Columbia Heights. So it was, everybody was either Hispanic or Black. So it was a really big change in the environment. Everything was different. I think Chavez was, like, my experience there was pretty good. Well, so-so. I still was struggling during that time. Like, I had extremely bad mental health again. So that kind of made everything worse in school. So school-wise, it was pretty bad. But I did have a teacher that did really care about me. I forgot her name. She was like a science teacher. But she would help me out a lot with like all my other topics. So like history, math, English, and science. Like, if I would be behind, she would help me. She was a pretty big part of the reason why I even moved on from the other grade.
And what was that new environment like, as far as the students? Well, you mentioned the demographic was totally different. Were there other significant differences, maybe like as far as resources or as far as just the general vibe of the place?
I feel like Bases, they have so much expectation from you, especially having kids coming from Oyster Adams. I don't know what other schools, but they're like schools that, you know, prepare students that have like advanced education. And so I feel like they already expected you to know these things and expect you, again, like the expectation was like way up. But here in Chavez, I feel like it was easier for me and I think for other students to go to their teachers or administrator and be like, hey, I have trouble with this. What can I do? For example, I was pretty low on my math. It was like my math exam and I was having trouble in math. And they had this program called Math Lab. So when they realized that I was having trouble with that, they put me there. So I was able to focus to also like strengthen my knowledge in math. So that was something that Bases kind of didn't really have. Like, they expected you to know. And even if they tried and tried and you still didn't know, like, they would just give up and be like, okay, then I don't know what you want me to do.
So you felt like there was more of a support system at this school?
Definitely. I feel like, especially the way that there was also great resources for, like, families, which there was none in the old school that I was at.
And I know you brought up mental health a couple of times, and so I just wanted to talk a little bit more about that, if that's okay. Because I do think it's important to recognize that, since I feel like it's become a subject that it has become less taboo over the years, mm-hmm. or in recent years. And, you know, it's interesting that you said one of the reasons you guys moved was to be able to get health insurance and access mm-hmm. those mental health resources. So can you tell us a little bit more about what that experience was like, and how did your parents maybe become aware that you were having mental health problems?
So I don't know how to say this, like, in the Hispanic community, I feel we're like, some of us are very religious, like families are very religious, so there were times where it's like, if you are feeling some type of way, go to church and talk about it, and that should make you feel better, or pray about it. My parents were religious, but it wasn't to the extent to where I had, if they knew I was feeling, you know, down or something, go to church and pray about it. They didn't do that. But I know there are some families that do say that, but they didn't really know about it until I was at BASIS, where I was just not, like, the state where I was at, I was not okay. And they could see it, but it was, I don't think they really knew how to approach it. Because again, like, it's something that people don't really would talk about during that time. Like, so they kind of realized it until I became suicidal, and they had to call, it was like the Catholic, I forgot what it was. It was like this, it's like this organization where they have to come and evaluate you. And they did that twice in BASIS. But it was still something that I don't think they were really concerned about until I went to Chavez. And they saw that, you know, like, the environment was different. They maybe thought, like, oh, if that we change her environment, so, you know, she's going to probably feel better. But that was not really the case. So I started having anxiety attacks on a daily basis. And I would be taken, like, to the hospital because people didn't really know. I didn't know I had anxiety attacks. My parents didn't know. The teachers didn't know. So they finally diagnosed me with anxiety. And then from that day on, like, they started, like, to talk to me about it. They went and reached out to different therapists and different organizations like LOIC, Mary Center, to look for programs. I was in it was like this intensive program where it was like, I had a therapist and a caseworker or social worker. I don't really remember, but it's like a therapist and someone who helps you out in school. So would go to your school, see how you're doing. And if you're not doing good, like, find you a tutor or stuff like that. And then after that, it did get a little bit worse, especially even after I went to Paul. I did start having, again, suicidal thoughts. I would self-harm. I would just have anxiety attacks every single day, and it was like really tiring. I was kind of tired of it, but, you know, I couldn't really control it. It just kept coming and coming. And then I think by that time, I feel like my parents were a little bit more supportive about the whole mental issues that I, yeah, my mental health.
So you felt like they had taken the time to learn more about what was going on?
Yeah, there were some times where I thought they weren't going to learn, especially my mom, because my parents are divorced. My dad actually went back to El Salvador. So I would just live with my mom. And so I would see her literally every day. So my mom, she struggled a lot with trying to learn about the situation and the problems I was having, but she did learn. So it took a little bit, but she did learn.
And in all of this, I guess, who did you feel like you could lean on, you know, besides your parents?
I would sometimes talk to my best friend, but the problem with my depression was I didn't really talk about it either. I didn't really want to talk about it because I felt like I was putting my issues onto someone, and I didn't want that because maybe they already had problems that they have to face. I didn't want to put my problems onto them. So I wouldn't really talk to just anyone. Sometimes I would talk to my therapist, but it was like an off and on thing for me. I sometimes didn't even want to talk. So it was, yeah, it was kind of difficult.
And I just wanted to go back a little bit because you mentioned LAYC. So can you talk a little bit about what role they had in your life? Or maybe what was that experience like when you were in that intensive program that you talked about?
I was there for a little bit because of the program that they had, and I loved the program. Both my therapist and my caseworker was amazing, especially my caseworker. She was a very interesting person. We would like just sometimes talk about like shoes or just clothes or hair or, you know. So in that program, you can literally just hang out with that person. So I feel like that helped me a lot to have someone that I could literally call. They would have like an on-call thing. So they would kind of switch around. So like one night would be like my caseworker and then the other night would be like my therapist. So I felt like if I needed them, there would just be one call away. So they played a huge role into getting better, even though there was to a point where the program ended for me, they would still call and check in. So that kind of made it better, you know, because there are people who would just see you as just the case. And like after you're done, they're just like, you know, they move on to the next. But I felt like they were deeply invested in trying to help me. So,
and I wanted to know also a little bit more, if it's okay just to go back, because you did mention that your parents, when you were in El Salvador, they were viajeros, they were, you know, going back and forth. And so once they decided to come here with you and decided to stay, what did they do for a living moving forward?
So my dad, he did construction until the day that he left. He had like his own little company. My mom has always been cleaning houses, but she did get her CDA during this time. She works like at a daycare sometimes. I think we had recently came in when she got her CDA. She worked at the Barbara Chamber. So she has done some things with child education.
And you mentioned that he had to leave, of course, and what is your relationship with him now, if any, if you have one at all?
Well, he had to leave because he got a job offer in El Salvador to work for an organization. As I mentioned before, he had a little company, but this was during the whole Donald Trump administration. So there was, you know, a lot of redadas. And after he left the house, he went and he lived in Woodbridge, Virginia. So it was really hard to know that he would be safe coming from like DC to like Virginia, like commuting, because you never know where a redada would happen. Like, it was just nerve-wracking. I felt like he was more safe going back to El Salvador on his own terms than him getting deported. But our relationship still remains strong. Like, we call each other all the time. We video chat. Yeah, like, our relationship still goes strong. Like, even though he's in El Salvador, I do miss him. Especially in the holidays and on my birthday. Like, it does get a little bit tough and I do cry. But, you know, I feel like he's way more safer in El Salvador than he was here, especially during that time.
And when did he go back?
Well, he left in 2017. So that's when.
And going back to your years in high school, can you describe to us a little bit about what that trajectory was like? You know, whether it was maybe challenges or things that happened or even classes that you were taking?
When I was going through my high school years, I didn't really think about how my status would affect me as I went on. I just thought that everything was gonna be okay. Like, I could just get a job and not really have to worry about me being undocumented. But as I started going through high school, there were situations where that kind of was an obstacle. For example, I think this was 11th grade. I was invited to this conference because I was in this little group where we talked about how can we, as students, make the consequences, let's say for, because if you do something, like, you either get suspended or expelled, how can we change it, especially for us, like, if we come from a different background, that maybe our life isn't as nice, like, what can we do? So they had, like, this conference in Colorado. It was paid for, like, the airplane, like, the ticket was, like, paid for. Where I was gonna stay at, it was paid for. They were even gonna give me money if I wanted to go out and, like, buy something. Everything was paid for, and they wanted me to go, but I couldn't go because I couldn't travel, and I was pretty bummed out. So I think from that day, I think it kind of hit me that this is actually serious. I'm going to have obstacles. And especially in senior year, applying to, like, financial aid, I couldn't do that. Different scholarships, I couldn't do that because I didn't have status. So things like that, when people would talk about, like, if they would have people come from different, like, colleges or something like that, and, like, would talk about it, and I'm like, hey, like, can kids that aren't documented, what do we have to do? And they would tell us, you would have to pay, like, as an international student, or you would have to pay as a out-of-state student, because I was undocumented, or I'm undocumented. So it was really tough. I feel like it got to a point where I wasn't motivated to even go to school anymore. Like, what's the point? If there is nothing to help me, then why should I continue this? As much as I wanted to continue, I just got so unmotivated.
And did you meet anyone during high school or even before that you saw was going through something similar?
No. My cousin, he got DACA before he graduated high school, so he was able to, you know, at least get a little bit of help. But after that, no. I didn't really know anybody. So that, I feel like that's what kind of also made it difficult for me, because I didn't have anybody that I could turn to and be like, hey, like, I know you've gone through this before. Like, what should I do? Like, I didn't have anyone.
And was there anybody at school, I guess, talking to you about this? I mean, I know you said that there were people you could turn to, like the administrator you mentioned. Was that a person that you ever talked to about what was going on?
I did talk to her about it. She was really upset because she's like, I don't understand, like, you're so smart, you're capable of doing this. I think she was, like, really mad about the fact that I didn't get any help. But I felt like as much as I could talk to someone, I just felt like they couldn't get it. I just felt like they didn't really understand how I felt or, you know, what I've gone through.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You know, as you were thinking of pursuing a higher education, did you start looking for alternatives elsewhere that you weren't necessarily getting at school?
Actually, I had a counselor. She was amazing. I told her about my situation, and she would still try to help me, which is something that I had to, like, advocate for at school, because some of the resources that they would give us, it wasn't really meant for people who are undocumented. So I had to advocate for that. Like, I would tell them, hey, there's people in this school that don't have anything. Can you help us find the resources? Because again, we're like first generation of going into college. We've never really had anybody to help. We don't have anybody in our corner to really help us. Can you help us?
And what was the response to that?
Well, she really tried to help us find different things. Well, for me, she gave me like a waiver so I didn't have to like pay for application fees. I was like, thank you, because I was not going to pay, no, $60. She found some scholarships that I could apply to. Yeah, she, you know, she would talk to the admissions office of like a college and explain the situation and try to see what could they do. So she was a big help.
And what schools did you end up applying to?
I applied to George Mason, I applied to North Carolina Central, I applied to UDC, I applied to Marymount, I applied to Bowie State, I applied to other colleges, I don't really remember. I actually got accepted to most of the colleges, but again, it was just the tuition and them having to tell me, hey, you have to pay more since you're undocumented. But I got to stay at UDC, so.
And I guess coming back to the question of immigration status, right? I know you said that you didn't really start talking to your parents about this until you were 15. So can you just kind of describe what those conversations were like and maybe who initiated the conversation?
I had recently just turned 15 and DACA was approved. And it was a big deal. I didn't really understand what was a big deal about it, to be honest. I was confused. Again, I didn't really know about it until my parents were like, this is what DACA does. And I was kind of confused about it because I'm like, I didn't really know about this. They would tell me, you know, you're gonna have a lot of obstacles once you start growing up. I feel like this is what I like talk about. For most of us, we feel like the option for us as teenagers or as young adults is to get married with a citizen. Like, that's like the thing. And that conversation has been brought up multiple times, which sucks because I'm like, I don't want to get married just to have that. Like, if I want to get something, I want to get it by myself. I don't want to feel like I am dependent on someone. And so that was mostly the conversations that we had. Like, if you're not able to get something, you know, your only option is to get married.
So when, you know, DACA came about and your parents started talking about it, did you all seek out information or legal assistance anywhere to find out more about the process, or what was that like?
We talked to people at CASA as much as we wanted. We didn't really have the funds to do it, so we weren't really able to have me apply to DACA. But recently, when Biden came into office and he said that he reopened it, I was able to apply. But the situation right now, yeah,
it got more complicated with the most recent court decision, for sure. And have you heard anything about that? Like, I know you kind of mentioned that you're in communication with your lawyer. right?
I don't have a lawyer. My cousin, he's a lawyer, but he filled it up for me. I've technically have been doing it by myself. I went to go put my biometrics a month ago. Well, actually about to be 2 months ago, but I haven't heard anything so far. So I don't know where I stand.
And I'm just curious, because I know you mentioned you found out about it when it initially came out. So when it came out, you knew that you qualified for sure, and you guys just weren't able to afford it at the time. And over the years, did anything change? Or what happened in that period of time between the time it came out and now that you're now more recently applying?
My mom tells me that sometimes she feels like it's her fault that I wasn't able to apply, because she says that she relied a lot on my father to like pay for the application. And now that she's become more dependent of herself, she has been able to get that money and be like, doesn't matter if I'm going to go broke, you're gonna get that, you're going to apply. So I think it's been growing of her like saying, I don't care if we're gonna eat frijoles and like, I don't know, like go just go broke. She doesn't care. She's like, I want you to apply.
And I guess going back a little bit to high school, can you tell us more about the events leading up to graduation and what was that like?
So I was kind of scared about me graduating because I was able to get a scholarship, but I didn't know if they were gonna pay for my whole tuition or if I had to pay most of it, because again, my mom is the only one that works in like the family. She wants me to be a full-time student. So I was mostly concerned, like, what if we can't pay for it? What's gonna happen? So I think I was really nervous about it. And plus the whole pandemic happened. So it kind of sucked, the whole graduation thing. We had to do a drive-by graduation, but that sucked. But after that, I think this was like 2 days before my graduation, I had found out that they were gonna pay for all my tuition. So I was like, okay, yeah.
And now that you mentioned that you're one of the people that graduated during this whole pandemic, can you tell us more about what the pandemic has been like for you and maybe, you know, your loved ones?
So the whole pandemic, it was pretty bad, especially during the middle of it. We had to stop going to school, and it sucked because, again, that's my senior year. I wanted to do all the activities that we had planned. But for some reason, I didn't really mind being at home for school. I was able to get a 4.0 GPA during the pandemic. I'm just confused because a lot of people struggled with it, and I'm like, I don't understand. But my aunt did get COVID. We had a lot of COVID scares, especially during like the middle of it. But I wasn't able to go out because my mom she has high blood pressure. So I couldn't go out. I don't know. It was like my conscience, it just wouldn't let me go out, you know, because just in case anything happens to my mom, like, I would just be a wreck. And it also took a really big toll on my mom's mental health. She barely went outside because she was scared. Like, I felt like it was so much fear that it was causing, the pandemic was causing that. Well, for my mom, she barely went out. She like got depressed for a while. I got depressed too because I couldn't go outside. I didn't have a social life, and it was bad. The whole pandemic was bad.
Well, what was it like having your graduation in the middle of all this? When did you graduate, by the way?
I graduated in June of 2020. Honest, I didn't like it because, again, like, I wanted to like walk across the stage. It's a really big achievement, especially for me. Like, I've gone through so much. For me just to graduate on a drive-by graduation. So I was really upset. And then on top of that, you know, you have people like making fun of it on social media. And I'm like, bro, like, that's not something you guys should be like making fun of, because there's, you know, it's actually something that people are proud of. And the whole situation of the pandemic and us not being able to have a normal graduation is not funny. But it was, honestly, it wasn't really that bad. They made it special. Like, they had, like, all the teachers out. They were, like, playing music. They would call our names, and then we would, like, get out of the car and then pick up, like, my diploma and then take pictures and then just get in your car and then just go. So, it wasn't bad. I mean, I kind of had fun. To be honest, it was pretty fun.
And just going back to, you know, one of the main things that we're kind of exploring through this project is, I guess, changes in the Dreamers movement, and also just to see the connection between identity and how people perceive themselves. Mm-hmm. This term Dreamer that has come about 2 decades ago and that has become very, well, often used in conversations about immigration. Mm-hmm. Let's just put it that way. So we just wanted to know, what has been your exposure to the Dreamers movement? Like, if you have been aware of it, how did you become aware of it?
So I wasn't really aware of it until, like, I would see it on TV, but didn't really have the knowledge of it until recently, where I, how do I say this? Before, I was really scared to say that I was undocumented and that I am able to receive DACA. I felt like that was something that I couldn't really talk about. But for a while now, like, I don't have that mentality anymore. Like, I can be like that. I'm proud of being undocumented. I'm proud of being, even if I don't have DACA, I'm a dreamer. I have dreams. So I'm not afraid to say it. But I really do love what they're doing. I've had help from the whole United We Dream. I've spoken to Harrison, I think. He's part of it. And I see them, like, do protests, which I really want to do one day. But I never really get the chance to. But I really love what they're doing. I feel like it's, especially for us, like, we're here to work, we're here to study, like, why can't we do it? You know what I'm saying?
And how did you connect with United We Dream?
I don't know if this was like a month ago, 2 months ago, where undocumented students were able to get financial help from the colleges or the universities. And I was really interested in that because, of course, I need help, you know? So I reached out to the UDC Latinx organization, and Harrison, who is part of the United We Dream, spoke to me about it. And I went on Google and searched it up.
And what were those conversations like? And I'm curious too, because I know you said that you hadn't really come across other people growing up that were experiencing similar circumstances. So what was that interaction like, meeting someone in this organization?
It was really nice to talk to someone who maybe isn't undocumented, but works with people who are undocumented, works with people who have gone through the same things that I've gone through, or are probably going to go through things that I've gone through. And their experience, like, it felt nice to actually talk to someone who, again, hasn't really maybe gone through it, but knows people who have gone through it and could probably, like, give me advice on what to do. So it was really nice to feel like I have someone that actually understood.
That's good. And I'm also curious, because I know you mentioned, you know, before it was difficult to talk about this with anyone. So I was just wondering, like, what are maybe some of the feelings or even mentality associated with that? Like, do you feel like it was because you were afraid or ashamed, or what was that mentality like versus now and how you see yourself now?
I was scared. I was mostly scared of how would people react to knowing she is not from here. She doesn't have a status. I was kind of afraid of what people would do or say. But I feel like as I got a little bit more older, I kind of realized that that's part of who I am. Like, that makes me me. That makes me Maria. Like, maybe the circumstances aren't that good, but the reason why I am who I am now is because of that. If I'm being honest, like, if I wasn't in this circumstance, I wouldn't fight to be good or to be something in life.
And I'm asking because also, you know, not everybody's the same. Mm-hmm. Like, even if we're in similar circumstances, it doesn't mean we've been through the same thing.
Yeah.
We do want to know more about how people see themselves. And do you know where that fear came from at all? Like, did it have anything to do with what you were told in your household or things you saw around you? Or where did that fear originate?
Sometimes what I was told in my household of, you have to stay low key. You have to stay on the low. You cannot make yourself seen, because if you make yourself seen, you can get deported or you can get your family members deported. That was kind of my mindset before. That was, if I talk about who I am, I can either get deported or my parents can get deported. And I felt like that created an immense amount of fear that I just didn't talk about it. Yeah, it was just something that I was scared to talk about, especially like around my friends. Like, some of my friends didn't, well, most of my friends didn't even know like I was in this situation until later on, where I'd be like, I can't do this because I'm this. They're like, oh my God, I didn't even know. Like, there were times where people didn't even know that I was undocumented because of the amount of English that I talked. They're like, oh my God, I didn't even realize that. I wouldn't even know you talk English so well. And I'm like, yeah, that, yeah. So yeah, it was mostly that. It was the fear of people finding out and what can happen after that.
And I'm also interested in, you know, the other family members that you mentioned, in knowing, I guess, more about their journey, if you know any of the details or have been told any stories. Because I know that there's, like, a large Salvadoran population here in D.C., and, I mean, there are a lot of reasons, right? Not just from the Civil War, but also people who have come because of those familial connections they already have here. So I was wondering if you know any stories about how your other family members have come or why?
My aunt came, she came by herself. Her name is Liliana. She's my mom's sister. She came because she wanted a better life. She had a kid, my cousin. By the time she got here, he was, I think, 10. She just wanted to be able to take care of him, like have money to, you know, buy him clothes, buy him food, things like that. My other cousin, David, he came with his family by foot. He came across the border because, again, they wanted him to have a better life, better education. I feel like most of the people in my family would come because they wanted a better education, better future.
And what about El Salvador? Like, do you still stay in touch with your family there? And how often do you communicate?
I definitely have family there. We communicate technically on a daily basis. My grandpa has recently gotten diagnosed with lung cancer, so that's been a kind of a reason why we've been talking on a daily basis, just to, you know, check on him, talk about like how his chemo has been going. So yeah, we like still have communication.
And one of the things I forgot to ask you, as far as school goes, was if you were involved in any extracurricular activities or anything like that when you were going to school.
I was involved with dance, a little bit of dance. Wasn't, you know, I did cheer in middle school. I think that was mostly it. I think during my 11th and 12th grade, I was kind of more focused on trying to get better and do better in school because I was trying to kind of catch up from me not doing so well because of how bad my mental health was, that I kind of wanted to get better, like, you know, show, because there was a lot of people doubted me. They would be like, oh, you know, you're not going to graduate. You know, you're not even going to do good. So I felt like I was mostly focused on trying to prove people that I was going to graduate, that I wasn't really focused on something else.
That's good. And, well, first of all, I also wanted to know, was college always an expectation from your parents or in your family?
For sure. It has always been an expectation until recently. I think my aunt has kind of helped kind of shift that mentality a little bit because, for example, I forgot what we were talking about one day. We were having a conversation and it was me, my mother, and my aunt. And she's like, yeah, like, it shouldn't matter if you do go to college. If you don't want to go to college, find yourself a job that you want. So I think after that, my mom kind of started realizing, like, college doesn't always have to be the expectation. But unfortunately, that is the expectation in the immigrant community.
So for this, it was, like, always an expectation thing, yeah, for you anyway?
It was definitely an expectation. My mom wanted me to be a lawyer. I don't know why lawyer and doctor is, like, the main thing that, you know, parents want children to be.
I think a lot of times it has to do with not just, like, the prestige of the profession itself, but also because they tend to be higher-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think some people don't realize that the cost of getting that education is also higher.
Yeah.
It takes longer to pay it off if you take out loans. But yeah, no, you're right. And I guess how did they react when they found out you wanted to study psychology?
My parents have always been supportive on what I want. Even though my mom wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor, like, she kind of realized that it all depends on what we want to do because we're the ones that are going to school for it. Like, we're going to work in that profession. So they've always been supportive on that. My mom loved the idea of that. First, I've always told her that hopefully one day I'll, like, work in the FBI because that's what I've always wanted to do. So my mom's like, yes. Again, she's really supportive on that.
And I know you're doing a summer program, mm-hmm, this year. So can you tell us more about that, how you got involved?
I've always done SYEP. I've been doing it for 4 years already. So it's been a while. So it was kind of random that I was put into Hola Cultura. I was supposed to go to Mary Center, but they put me in Hola. And at first, I was kind of debating on it. But I was like, let me give it a try. Maybe I'll like it. And that's exactly what happened. Like, I really love the program.
And now that you mentioned you've been in SYEP before, what other organizations or places have you worked at?
I worked for Mary Steiner since the beginning. I've done the Embassy of El Salvador. I worked at the Marie Reed with their program, like their summer school. Last year, I did LAYC and I did the call center. So in the pandemic, we were calling people who had called before in the office to ask for resources. So we would call them back and see if they needed any more help or if they got what they needed.
And what kinds of roles have you had at some of the other places?
So for the Embassy of El Salvador, not the embassy, I'm sorry, the Consulate of El Salvador, I was mostly helping around, like, the workers that needed help. So for example, I worked with helping people with their applications. I printed things. I put information in the computer, things like that. And for reread, I was helping a teacher. So I was technically a teacher's assistant. So I would help them, like, I would help little kids. I think it was kindergarten. So I would help them with anything they needed.
So I just wanted to conclude by asking about maybe your future aspirations or your vision for the future in general.
Well, I really hope that I'll be getting my master's degree after I graduate from my bachelor's. And after that, maybe going into my PhD. And working at the FBI is like my goal. But if not, maybe working at a clinic as a clinical psychologist.
And I know you're in like a very particular situation with your DACA application, right? So I also wanted to know if you could say anything to legislators and basically the people, you know, in charge of making these decisions that affect a lot of us on a daily basis. What would you say to them?
To put themselves in our shoes. Like, we're actually here to make a difference. Like, we're here to work and to study. I don't know, like, it's hard. I don't know how to say it, but just to think about that. Like, we're not here to just, again, how some people think, live off of the government. Like, we're actually here to do what we have to do, which is go to school and succeed.
Thank you, Maria, for sharing your story with us. Join us next week where we'll speak with our anonymous narrator using the pseudonym Jacinto Maldonado Torres, who is a local D.C. organizer who came to Washington, D.C. in 2010 at the age of 15. Don't forget to follow us on all social media platforms at Hola Cultura D.C. and subscribe to the podcast to always be the first to know when new weekly episodes are published. As an added bonus, if you subscribe and follow Hola Cultura social channels and share your own immigration experience with us, you'll get a chance to be featured on the Hola Cultura Instagram page.